My castaway this week is a writer. An only child, absorbed into an adult world, she published her first novel when she was 19. The critics thought it surprisingly mature, but after an unsuccessful second novel, its author fell more or less silent for 5 years. But then the books came thick and fast. Between 68 and 74, she produced many of her best-known works, including I'm the King of the Castle, Strange Meeting, and The Bird of Night, collecting 3 prestigious awards as she did so and becoming one of the country's best-known novelists. More recently, she published Mrs. De Winter, an acclaimed sequel to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. Many of her books contain echoes of her childhood. Loneliness and isolation are 2 of her strongest themes. "I've always been incredibly secretive as a writer," she says. "If it's seen by anyone else, it's gone and I'm not interested." She is Susan Hill. Why is your writing such a secret process, Susan? I mean, you know you've got to go public in the end. Why don't you share it along the way?
I don't know. Some writers do. I prefer the word private to secret. Secret implies something guilty. I just cannot bear anyone to know anything at all about what's going on between me and the paper while it's happening. It kills it.
But you have to have great self-confidence to do that, don't you? I mean, other people would want to be reassured along the way by somebody whose judgment they trusted that you know, you were writing something interesting, worth reading.
Yes, they do. I know. And I think it's just different. I have to have rock solid confidence, which I always have during the writing, absolutely. And the minute it's finished and I read it, it evaporates totally down a black hole and I lose confidence in it entirely. I feel that it's the worst thing ever written.
I wonder, though, if you're so private, as you call it, about that writing, because that's what you did as a child when you wrote, because your parents, your mother in particular, didn't appreciate what you were doing. So you were kind of closed in and private about it then, almost writing metaphorically under the bedclothes, weren't you?
Yes, I think one got used to being like that. I think only children spend a lot of time inside themselves anyway, and small children do have a very private world going on. And I did, and I suppose writing fiction is only an extension of that.
What you also say, refreshingly, is that you couldn't bear to teach creative writing, that you'd rather take your clothes off in front of a class than teach them how to write. I mean, again, that's part of the same thing, isn't it?
I couldn't teach it because I couldn't share. I could never have gone to any writing class where I had to read things out to other people. I really would curl up and die in a corner.
But eventually you have to let it go and let it become public. Don't tell me that you don't get a thrill then, even if you do think it's the worst thing you've ever written, seeing it, feeling it between 2 hard covers, seeing it propped up in the bookshop.
Oh, it's always a thrill. Doesn't, never fails. You see your book in a bookshop on a shelf and you see somebody reading it. The biggest thrill of all, actually, is meeting a reader who comes up with a rather battered copy of a book, which you know has been loved and read, and says rather shyly, "Would you sign it? Because I've loved this for so many years." That's what it's about.
Tell me about your first record.
This record is Mozart. It has to stand for all of Mozart, probably the greatest composer ever. I beg a question. It's just the trio from Così fan tutte when the young men are going off to war.
Suave si il vento from Mozart's Così fan tutte, sung by Montserrat Caballé, Janet Baker and Richard Van Allen with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Susan Hill, you wrote the sequel to Rebecca, Mrs. De Winter, a few years ago. A challenging project, I would have thought, to be. I mean, you've got to be quite audacious to agree to do it, haven't you?
I did it because Rebecca has always been a favourite book of mine, because I think it's a much better novel than a lot of people made it out to be. People tend to dismiss it as a romance that they read when they're 15. I love a challenge. I'd always wondered what happened to those people afterwards. It was magical. I could decide where they'd gone and what happened to them.
When you say magical, it just flowed. You say you wrote it very quickly. It was an easy exercise in the end, was it?
Easy, perhaps not, but it certainly flowed. All the best things do.
I'm just asking you really about things mystic. Did you feel Daphne du Maurier around you as you wrote?
No, I don't think I did that.
But again, because you're mistress of the ghost story, so there's part of that in you, isn't there?
I wrote it very quickly. I read Rebecca again and then put it away and wrote my own book. But her cadences were certainly in my ear. I think I'm always a haunted writer in the sense that I do hear everything I'm writing in my ear as if it were being dictated before I write it down. Now, by that, I don't mean anything spooky at all. There is a sort of dictating machine that comes out, and when it's going really well, I can't catch up with it. This voice is saying. I suppose this is what some people have meant by automatic writing in that rather wicked way that they try to convince people that it's by some discarnate spirit. I don't do that at all.
But do you believe in ghosts?
I do feel that places have a presence in them, which can often be unpleasant. This is well recorded. I think sometimes a lot of the stories are fanciful, but I do actually feel that there are some instances where people have seen what we call ghosts, which you can't explain by any other means. I suppose there must be. Yeah, a lot of it is just fun, though, isn't it?
It was said you were paid £1 million for writing Mrs. de Winter, which would be another good reason for not refusing to do it. Can you confirm that?
Oh, it's complete nonsense. I occasionally read reports in the newspaper about my bank balance, and they seem to know rather more about my bank account than I do myself. I have not earned £1 million from Mrs. de Winter. I never did. I've never been a millionaire or anything approaching it. Because my salary, if I were, let us say, a civil servant, would be a matter of public record, I see no reason whatsoever to not make things a matter of public record. I had one bumper year of earnings, I suppose about 1993-94 tax year, when after 40% tax, after everybody's share of what I was earning from various sources, I mean agents and whatever, after paying 50%, remember, to the Daphne du Maurier estate, as with the earnings from The Woman in Black, I share 50-50 with the person who made the play out of it. In that one glorious year, after all these deductions, I earned approaching £400,000, which is a very great deal of money. And I'm not complaining. I've never earned anything remotely like that before or since.
Record number two.
This is to remind me of my mother. When I was a child, I spent a lot of time alone with my mother, and my mother was a great goer to the theatre in Scarborough and to the cinema, and we regularly went to see Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and I inherited from my mother an absolute passion for Fred Astaire, who was a genius. And this is Fred Astaire singing and dancing Pick Yourself Up. It's partly because I imagine myself as a child dancing across those wonderful futurist cinema marble floors as we came out of the cinema, and my mother secretly doing the same. And because I love the sentiments. I mean, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, start all over again. It can't be a bad motto.
When I remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again, I take a deep breath. Pick yourself up, dust myself off, and start all over again.
Fred Astaire and Pick Yourself Up and Memories of Your Childhood, Susan Hill. You were not, you've said, the kind of child my mother had in mind. How did you fall short?
I think she wanted a very different daughter. She was a dressmaker of great talent, dress designer, very smart, neat, organised person. And she got this daughter who wasn't interested in clothes, who didn't want to be dressed up, who was bookish, solitary, solemn, serious, rather bolshy, strong-minded. She didn't know how to relate to me, except, of course, as a mother. She didn't understand me, I didn't understand her. We spent too much time locked together, which wasn't good for either of us. If I'd had siblings, it would have been easier.
What about your father? Did he offer any counterbalance to all of that?
Yes, my father was not very well educated, left school relatively early, but very intelligent and read a great deal, a deep thinker, a serious man. I didn't see a lot of him. Very dominated by my 5-foot fiery little mother, and he was a 6-foot gentle, completely hopeless man, really, of whom I was enormously fond.
So she and you spent a lot of time without him, as it were, in this rather strange house in Scarborough, full of old and rather sad people, is my impression of it.
Yes, Scarborough at that time was full of retired old ladies. Old ladies, of course, because often their sons and brothers had been killed in the First World War. This was in the Second World War. Lots of old ladies eking out small amounts of income in circumstances where they tried to keep up appearances. Lots of old ladies with very old daughters locked together, and I observed them. Small children and young children, especially ones like me, as I was, do see and think a lot about adult life and how curious it is.
So when you went out from that to school or whatever, out into the world a little further, what kind of image must you have presented? What must people have thought about you, the product of this rather strange background?
I don't know. I think people thought of me as slightly apart because I was bookish and solitary and serious. And I think that stayed with me in that you see yourselves sometimes as others see you. I believed that I was. And I've never lost this feeling of being just not quite at one with everybody else.
It's probably not surprising, therefore, that when you wrote your first novel, and you started writing it when you were really quite young, didn't you, sort of early teens?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
It's not surprising, then, that it was about some rather sad, miserable people and the breakup of a marriage. It was about adults. It certainly wasn't a children's story. You obviously didn't have to use a lot of imagination. You felt you knew all about it, did you?
Yes, it was also what I thought that adult novels ought to be. People would want to publish a book about grown-ups, not about children. And it was an extension of telling myself stories, having imaginary friends as a child. It just seemed natural to do it with a pen in my hand. Always has.
More music.
More music, yes, the oboe. I'm not really musical in the sense of being able to play anything, but I did take up the oboe. It's the instrument where, if ever I hear it, my lip starts to twitch and I pick up the oboe in my hands. This is the jolly part of Bellini's Oboe Concerto in E-flat major. The downside of being a very serious, reflective person who likes, embraces solitude and silence, it's easy to get melancholy, and I could see me on the island tipping over into the serious melancholia. So let's have the jolly bit of the Bellini.
Of Bellini's Oboe Concerto in E-flat major, played by Nicholas Daniel and the Peterborough String Orchestra. You got a degree in English, Susan, from London University, and then took half a job as literary editor of the Coventry Evening Post and another half job in the library of the cathedral. And you didn't really write anything other than stories for Woman's Realm for years then, until you were in your late 20s. Why did you suddenly dry up like that?
Oh, I think I had to dry up because I was earning a living, running a double books page of a provincial newspaper every week, reading and reviewing absolutely everything, from mountaineering and gardening to children's books and novels. I hadn't got the creative energy and the time.
But you were also in love, weren't you, with a man called David, who was the organist in the cathedral. Do you think the two things, being in love and not writing, are connected, that the one saps, as you put it, the creative energy required for the other?
I think there's something in that. I don't think, though, that there's quite as much in it as having children drawing on the same creative energies. But I was indeed completely absorbed in this love of this particular person, yeah.
But you also had another silence, as you say, in really during motherhood. There was 16-year silence later on when you married and had children. And you were writing during that time, but it was mainly short sprints, I think you've described it as, non-fiction, really, about the country or the kitchen or whatever, and articles and broadcasting and so on. But no marathons, no novels for 16 years. Again, it is just this being used up emotionally. Do you think it's a particularly female condition, that?
I think it is. Just inevitably, biologically, you are the person who is by nature required to devote all your energies to bearing and having your children. Writing serious fiction for me comes out of the same well as the emotions I put into having my children, and I couldn't do both together.
What happened to David?
He died. David died very suddenly, completely unexpectedly, of a coronary thrombosis. He went for a walk with a friend just before Easter, felt unwell, went into a small church in Gloucestershire, not far from where I now live, lay down on the bench and died, while his friend who was with him went off to try and get the car. We'd had a very stormy and difficult 8 years of relationship, both very independent and fierce people. I think it was just about to come right. It was, I think, the blow in life and the shock in life, which I have never got over, really. Nothing's ever been quite so rending as that was.
How old was he?
43. No age.
Record number four.
Record number four really links me very much to that time with David and the time I spent at Coventry Cathedral. I was down in the library, which is in the Undercroft, or was, one afternoon, and upstairs I knew there was a big rehearsal going on for a huge concert that was taking place, the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. It's John Barbarolli, and a young cellist I didn't know much about called Jacqueline Dupre. And David came downstairs and came into the library and said, if you want to hear greatness being born, creep upstairs, hide yourself under a chair at the back. He's rehearsing the Elgar with Dupre. Don't let him see you. He doesn't like visitors, doesn't like people listening. I did as he told me, and I sat in the dark looking at Jacqueline Dupre's golden hair streaming and flying like angel's hair, playing her cello like a demon, hearing the orchestra, who were only rehearsing, make music that I think I've never heard the like of before or since. And not only watching Barbarolli as an electrifying conductor, but watching him watch her with such pride and tenderness as she played this Elgar cello concerto.
Part of Elgar's cello concerto played by Jacqueline Dupre with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbarolli. You had a kind of golden period, Susan Hill, between the ages of about 26 and 31. You produced about 8 novels, including your bestseller, I'm the King of the Castle, and the novel many say is your best work, Strange Meeting, about 2 young officers in the First World War. And you made your name, really. Now, Strange Meeting and several others were written in Aldborough in Suffolk, which we connect very much with Benjamin Britten, and it was because of him that you went there, wasn't it? Can you explain that?
Yes, it was. And to go back to school, I was sitting in the music room at school one afternoon, and the music mistress said, now, you're all going to listen to this and then tell me what you think. And I never, as far as I know, heard any Britten. And she turned on the gramophone, and out came the Sea Interlude from Peter Grimes, Britten's opera, and I was absolutely bowled over and carried away by this music. I went out and found every record of Britten that I could borrow and played it. And I began to read about him and to hear about him. In a way, this was the key to opening the door to my own great burst of my best work. I can't explain how or why. He influenced me, he stimulated me, he inspired me. And, of course, I had to go to Aldborough. I wasn't sure that this place really existed, except in one of those marvellous landscapes of the imagination.
So it was a kind of pilgrimage when you went there?
Complete pilgrimage.
And you met him?
Oh, yes. I suppose the most exciting moment of my life. And
did
it's
he live
indescribable.
Up to everything? I mean, after all, you put him on such a pedestal. Can anybody have lived up to it?
Oh, absolutely, yes, of course he did. I know that he was a very difficult man, and I think he could be very tricky. I had nothing but admiration for him. I still don't, while recognising the other side. I think he was a genius. I don't think I've ever met a genius, perhaps one or two, but not like that. Oh, completely, yes. And I've never lost that. I only have to turn on Britain to want to write again, which is very strange, perhaps.
So you would go to Aldborough and rent a cottage eventually, did you, and just write and write?
Yeah, I rented a house by the sea, always in the winter, when it was bleak and grey and the sea was stormy. It's how I still love it best. I love that coast. And I would sit in the window, with the window open sometimes in mild days of February and March, hearing the sea, hearing the music of Peter Grimes coming across the sea, sometimes seeing Ben walk across the beach with his little dog. And it just flowed out of me in the same way, this outpouring of my best work. And I owe him everything.
Record number five.
Well, yes, I decided I wouldn't have the formative bit from Peter Grimes. I can hear that in the sea all around me on this island. I must have Peter Pears's voice, which I do think is one of the greatest tenors ever and is my favourite singing voice, male singing voice. And the two had this perfect collaboration musically. And in the end, I've chosen, perhaps surprisingly, one of Ben Britten's settings of a famous English folk song, Tom Bowling. And this must just stand for all Britain, all peers, and all that time.
Hear, hear how cries poor Tom Bowling, the darling of our crew. No more tempest howling, for death hath broached him to. His form was of the maidenliest beauty, his heart was kind and soft. Faithful below, Tom did his duty, and now he's gone alone.
Peter Pears, accompanied by Benjamin Britten and Tom Bowling. You married in the mid-70s, in your early 30s. You produced your daughter, Jessica, when you were 35, and then you suffered a series of miscarriages. And you seem, and you've written about this in great detail, which is why I can say what I have to say, you seem to have become desperate to have a second child. You talk about begging, praying for a baby. It became a complete obsession, didn't it?
I think it does. I think it takes you over in a way you have no control over it. And you can't see things in perspective. I couldn't have stopped, couldn't have given up. It's nature, I suppose, saying, come on, you're going to do this thing and I'm going to make you.
So you were eventually 42, having had Jessica, as I say, when you were 35. You were 42 when you became pregnant, but the pregnancy only continued to 24 weeks and your waters broke and eventually Imogen was born, only to die, tragically, 5 weeks later. Again, it's an experience you've written about in great detail. Can I ask you why? Again, because we were talking earlier on about things being so private, and this was so deeply private, so harrowing. Why did you want to write about it and make it public?
I think the writing of the book was, for me, it was cathartic. There's no doubt about that. Having done it, I know, absolutely certainly, that the book was for other people. Simply my file of letters proves that to me. The letters came from women who said, not just this happened to me and 24 pages later they had poured out their own story and said, I feel better. The letters came from the women who said, 40 years ago I had a stillborn child or a premature baby who died. I had forgotten about it, pushed it away. I knew that I had to read your book to help me deal with it.
There's that kind of altruistic part of it, but there's also the selfish part of, selfish in its strict sense, of letting your grief out in the writing, as you say. And, I mean, Again, that was something you'd done about David, wasn't it? The death, David's death, you'd written in the springtime of the year. About
that was very much through fiction, of course. Yeah.
Yes, but a woman coming to terms with the grief of the death of her husband in that case. And then there's an echo of that theme as well in The Woman in Black, isn't there? It's a piece
yes.
of genre writing, but it's about grief for a child which hasn't been released. Is that what you're saying to people? Let it out.
Yes. When people say, are your novels autobiographical? No, of course they're not. I don't write directly about my own life and what happened or take people out of real life and put them in books. But emotions are emotions, and until you've experienced them, you can't transmute them into fiction. So, of course, all that, every emotion felt by a character, is autobiographical.
But the writing of what happened over Imogen and the loss of Imogen was something that ultimately helped you come to terms with it all.
No, it helped me get it out of my system and put it down. And I think it helped a lot of other people when they read it. You never come to terms with it. You don't accept the death of your own small child, your baby. You don't want it to have happened. A long time afterwards, you see this curious pattern in the carpet. And I think you always do see it, that it was a sort of landmark on the journey. But, and you say things like, if she hadn't died, I wouldn't have had the next one, and how can life be without her? But you can't say that was for the best. No, you just try and make some sense out of the mess, really.
Record number 6.
This is very special. Talking of children, both my children were at Greycoat's School in Oxford, and I've chosen a favourite assembly hymn. It's called One More Step Along the World I Go. I've chosen it to remind me of those years. It encapsulates that time and that place where parents, staff, children, everyone were incredibly loving and supportive during all those years and during Imogen's birth and death. The whole school put its arms around us, really, in a way I can never describe adequately. It's been recorded specially for me to take on my desert island, sung for me, by the children of Botley Primary School, Oxford, whose head teacher and music teacher taught my own children when she was at Greycoat. So it's doubly special.
One More Step Along the World I Go, sung by the children of Botley Primary School, Oxford. I'm the King of the Castle, Susan Hill, is your bestseller, often a set text for school exams. It's about two 11-year-olds thrown together in the school holidays by their parents. Terrible hostility between them, and ultimately the gentler character is driven in the face of the other's evil to suicide. There's an awful darkness in that novel. It's often compared to Lord of the Flies. Where does that come from in you, if all of these things begin somewhere in a novelist's experience?
I think, as we said, when I was a child, I felt separate and apart and occasionally was treated as such. I'm not going to say that I was severely bullied, but there were nasty moments. Probably every child has those nasty moments at the mercy of another child. There is a darkness at the heart of things. I believe that ultimately the light triumphs, but there is evil in us all, I suppose, the Christian view of fallen man and original sin and so on. It's interesting about that book, I'm the King of the Castle. It is set for GCSE regularly, all the time. 11 to 15-year-old, 16-year-old boys all say, yeah, that's true, it's like that. The parents of young boys say, that's appalling, it isn't like that at all. How could you write that wicked, evil book? I think the young people know the truth, really.
So, and the young people write to you saying that they identify with Kingshaw, the suffering, the victim.
Yeah, I've never had a single letter telling me they identified with Hooper.
With Hooper, the bully, the evil one. But it's interesting that the novel prompts letters, that it touches people in that very personal way. Do you think that's part of the function of your fiction, apart from to entertain, to let people know that there are other people who feel like them?
I suppose it must be. At the time, of course, you don't think about anything other than writing about these people in this situation.
Writing a good story.
Yeah, and writing a good story, though the plot is the least of it. But you never think of the audience out there. That comes later. Then I suppose, yes, it is part of it. It has become part of it.
Number seven.
Ah, or Britain. We had Peter Pears's voice, which to me is the voice of the century. I think the young man singing this Britain song, Ian Bostridge, is going to be the tenor of the future, as Pears was of his generation. It's Benjamin Britten's setting of a poem by W.H. Auden. I didn't know much about poetry at all until I started to do A-level and we were given W.H. Auden to study. I'd never read any Auden, and it opened up this world of rather sinewy, knotty, modern poetry in a way I appreciated greatly. So to remind me of that, it's Britain's setting of Night Falls on the Rigid Land by W.H. Auden. It encapsulates a whole lot of other things too.
Night covers up a rigid land and ocean's quaking more. And shadows with a tall
Benjamin Britten's Night Covers Up the Rigid Land, sung by Ian Bostridge, accompanied by Graham Johnson. You're now 54. You're married to a man who's been described in print as a saint for his unflinching support for you doing all of this, who also happens to be an expert cook and a Shakespeare scholar. How can you bear to go to a desert island and leave him, I think, is the question.
It has never got over being called a saint. I think the trouble is leaving everything is difficult, but I'm somebody who has, as I get older, silence and solitude become ever more important. And to have silence and solitude, you have to do without the family, the friends, the companionship. But curiously, it just gets to matter more and more and more.
So you're looking forward to it?
Yes, I am. I am. Perhaps I shouldn't be. And I will have to battle with the melancholia. But I just feel that if I'm ever going to have another great flowering towards the end of my life, goodness, I hope I live till I'm 102, but I think you know what I mean, I will have to have it on my own in this desert island. Maybe then I can, in the sand anyway, write another six books in a row. But they've got to be born out of what's happened to me, plus the silence and the solitude, I'm afraid.
For someone who professes to like all this silence and solitude, you're an incredibly warm, talkative, gregarious person. How do you combine the two?
People always expect you to be like your books, I think. Somebody said to me not long ago, oh, but you're quite cheerful. Yes, one has, the public side, the social side. I hope I am, sometimes at least, cheerful company. I'm not very cheerful company for myself, I think. But that's all right, I can deal with that. But you're not your own books, except deep down.
Deep down you are.
I think so.
Last record.
Well, in the cause of cheering myself up, this is The Beatles. I thought that I might have chosen The Beatles in their philosophic mode, but I decided the best of The Beatles in those early 60s was when they jumped onto the stage, vibrating with energy and youth and vigour and cheerfulness, with their shiny Beatle haircuts flopping and those funny collarless suits. banging on their instruments and their drums. And they bounced us all into modern living, didn't they? It's Love Me Do.
Beatles and Love Me Do. Now the difficult one. Which of those eight, if you could only take one?
It's impossible, but I cannot do without hearing Britten and Piers. So I'll take Tom Bowling, please. It's very English too, and I suppose I am really, though not particularly flag-wavingly, so.
What about your book?
I'm going to take a book which unfailingly makes me laugh. It's been a good companion to me in tight corners and at dark moments for 30-odd years. It's Nancy Mitford's The Pursuit of Love, the great English humorous novel, but there's more to it than just a good laugh. Wonderful book.
And a luxury.
Ah, I'd like to take the Barnes collection, please. The great collection of Impressionist and modern paintings, a small fraction of which were brought to Europe and which I saw at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris a couple of years ago. But I want the whole Barnes collection from America, crated and shipped over. I think perhaps, may I have one to arrive per day in a crate, floated ashore? By the time I got off the island, if ever I do, I will have seen at close quarters more great pictures than anybody except Mr. Barnes.
Susan Hill, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, it's been huge fun. Thank you.
Thank you.